Hello, everyone. Welcome to the seventh or the penultimate episode of Let's Talk Elephants. I have been waiting a very long time for this episode of the show because we're going to be discussing a topic I'm very passionate about and have done a lot of research on myself. My guest this week is Dr. Marta Miana. Most of my listeners will recognize her as the former president of UNLV or the former dean of the Honors College. But to the rest of the world, she is better known for her research in psychology, relationships, and sexuality. She has acquired a number of accolades for her work, and she's even been featured on the Oprah Winfrey Show. Because she has such a lengthy record of professional accomplishments, I'm just going to go ahead and let her introduce herself properly. So, Dr. Miana, could you sort of just give people an idea of your professional background, where you started, where your research took you in this field or all the fields that you've researched in, and sort of what, you know, your personal biggest accomplishments are? Because some people might look at, you know, oh, she was on Oprah, like that's the peak of anyone's career. But it might be different for you personally. You know, it might be UNLV related or research related. So yeah, just kind of summarize your experience and your biggest accomplishments.
Sure. Thank you, Destiny. It's great to be here talking with you. I completed a PhD in clinical psychology, and my research for my dissertation was on a woman's sexuality problem that had received not just very little attention, but the wrong kind of attention. And that was a problem that is actually quite common, especially in young women, and that is the problem of genital pain during intercourse. And so this was a problem that was basically treated as if the women who had that dilemma had some psychological issue. And I was in the paradoxical position of being a psychologist who did research to show that it wasn't really related to a psychological issue or a relational issue or even to sexual abuse, which is what a lot of people assumed, but that in fact it was a physical problem. That we were psychologizing, as we have often done historically with women's health problems when we did not know the etiology of them. So that, I would say, was a major contribution to the literature and to the treatment of that problem. And I'm proud to say that because of that research, women who have this particular affliction are actually, by and large, in North America, treated properly and not just told that it's all in their head. So I would say that that was a major accomplishment for me. After my work on pain with intercourse, I moved into the area of sexual desire, which I find a fascinating area because it is affected by so many sociocultural factors and as well as biological ones and relational ones. So I think I have made some contributions in that area too. But, you know, I'm proud of a number of things, and they're not all just sex research related. They're about teaching and mentoring students and having PhD students who've gone on to make their own significant contributions. And then, of course, heading this wonderful university at a time of need was also something that I feel really good about.
Right. So are you, now that you've kind of resigned from president, are you teaching at UNLV or are you just...
So I will be teaching at UNLV. I still have a PhD student that I'm seeing through their dissertation. But yes, I am going back to faculty and going back to my real passion, which is to do research and to work with students and to turn students on to research and how incredibly exciting it is.
Right, right. So your main field is psychology, right?
Yes.
So would you say that your overall focus is in the genital pain and then in sexual desire? Like those are the two main topics?
I have not done any recent work on genital pain.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that I made my significant contribution to that area. So my later work has definitely focused on sexual desire, especially mm-hmm. female sexual desire.
Right. Is there something that pushed you in that direction, or it just was kind of like a segue from the the issue since you dealt with female genital pain before?
No, I don't. Obviously, they're connected. If you have pain, you're going to have less sexual desire because right. It's not a pleasant experience to have sex. But no, that it was always an interest of mine. Mm-hmm. But primarily what happened is I was also doing therapy, and so I had a clinical practice. The majority of my cases were about desire.
Right.
So the majority of my cases were women who came in with their partners because they were having issues around the fact that they did not feel desirous. And as a function of talking to all of these women, but also my own experience and the experience of my friends and just watching how the world works, mm-hmm. I thought that we were probably, you know, assuming a lot of untruths about female sexual desire because it's always been such a socioculturally loaded issue.
Right, yeah.
So that's how it came to it.
Okay. So sex is still very much a taboo in our culture. In U.S. culture, it's different around the world. But it's really strange to me because we sell sex and we profit heavily off of sex. You know, it's everywhere. It's in our movies, our music, our advertisements. We're exposed to it constantly, especially in Las Vegas. You know, Sin City, I remember being like 7 years old, walking down the strip, and there's cars driving by that have naked women on them. You know, so this is a unique sort of niche in itself. But it's really interesting to me that it's not controversial for us to blast sex on a casual level. And it's like a lot of times it's drastically misrepresented and it's not like an accurate source of information for sex. So we can do that. But then when it comes time to have a professional, informational, educational conversation about it, when it comes to, oh, should we teach sex ed in school? That's like, oh, we can't do that. We can't show them the right way to do it or the right way to talk about it. Has it been controversial for you to research this? Like, have you had any sort of stigma amongst your peers or colleagues or students because of the fact that you've researched human sexuality and sex?
Well, there's definitely a stigma. There's a lot less grant funding available when you study sexuality, even when there's sexual health problems, which are clearly health problems.
Right.
But if they touch on sexuality, it's much more difficult to get grant funding. Clearly, I belong to a community of sex researchers and scholars. So within that community, there's obviously no stigma. I have to say that my experience, both with students, colleagues that are not in the sex field, and certainly clients, is that there's such a relief in being able to have a serious conversation where you're not wigged out talking about real sexuality, not the sexuality you see on the billboards, you know, driving around this town. That's not sex. That's some kind of performance that doesn't really approximate what the real issues in sex tend to be. So yes, it is a stigmatized field to some extent. I think I've navigated it seriously enough and with enough comfort, because I'm perfectly comfortable talking about these things and for some bizarre reason always was.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have to get over anything to go into this, right?
Yeah.
And what you realize is that when you talk to people and you look incredibly comfortable talking about it, they become comfortable talking about it.
Right.
Which is why I'm a big proponent of being open about issues of sexuality, because if we're not, people are walking around in these bubbles thinking that what they experience and what they feel is weird and odd and strange and there's something wrong with them. And if we could all just like talk about it as if it's the natural thing that it is, then it would normalize the experience of most people.
Right. Obviously, I can attest to that. That's why I do any of this, you mm-hmm. know, because there's so many, you know, it's especially in sex because it's so intimate and so personal. But I feel like that principle applies to so many different controversial issues. You know, there's so many people that think, oh, I'm isolated, I'm alone, like I'm the only one that thinks like this. And when you are the brave one to step out and be like, hey, this is what I think, this is what I'm experiencing, you attract like people, you know, and it creates that community and that the level of comfort that you need to have serious conversations about things.
Yes.
So I get that. Do people often misinterpret your work or kind of inappropriately summarize it to seem like you're saying something you're not? Has that happened?
Oh, yes, of course, because especially the media wants to sensationalize what you do. Right. So the media will pick a soundbite out of context to make it sound like you're talking about sex in some salacious way when you're not at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, folks who want to sell TV shows, who want to sell newspapers will have a tendency. The other thing is that some of the points that I make are kind of complex and they're easy to misunderstand. And so you have to get journalists and writers who are willing to take the effort to understand what I'm saying instead of going for the sensationalist soundbite. So yeah, I've been misinterpreted for sure.
Right. That's frustrating.
Yeah.
So do you think that sexuality or sex ed or some element of sex in general is something that should be mandated in school and taught in school?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I definitely do. Again, with the right spirit and in the right kind of natural, there's nothing to be ashamed of way. Mm-hmm. But not just in school, in med school. I mean, one of the shocking things is how even issues of sexuality are not really taught very much in most med schools, when in fact it's, you know, the fascinating thing about a sexual episode is that it is at the same time simultaneously a biological event, a sociological event, and a psychological event, and an interpersonal event. But the biology of it is incredibly important.
Right.
Often, to give you an example, the way that we find out that an older man is having heart problems is when they start experiencing erectile dysfunction. And yet, the discomfort with sexuality is so ubiquitous that even in med school and even in psychological circles, one of the arguments I've made often is that all psychologists should know how to treat sexual problems as much as they know how to treat depression and anxiety, considering especially that sexual problems are far more common.
Right.
And yet there's this, oh, okay, yeah, I'm going to refer you to a sex therapist because I don't do that. It's like, how can you not do that?
Right.
It's such an integral part of most people's experience.
Right. So at what, you know, because this is a hot button topic, mm-hmm. What age do you introduce kids to that? Or is it in stages like, oh, first we're going to talk about the anatomy of the body and organs, and then we're going to move into STIs and contraception and things like that? Like in the ideal world, what does sex ed look like?
You know, I mean, I'm not a sex ed expert.
Right.
So I will leave that to those folks who do a great job. But I think that you don't have to get into the problematic aspects of it until much later.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing is to have young children not feel a sense of shame about it. Now, what happens at school is no contest for what happens at home. And that's the thing with kids, right? You can be doing all the right things in one setting, but if they're in an environment that teaches shame around sexuality, the fear is always that if you don't put shame on top of sexuality, that you're going to get promiscuity or wild behavior.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, there's reason to believe that it's the other way around. If you make it this secret, forbidden thing, that's much more likely to happen.
Right.
So what I would say is for the younger ages is just getting rid of that shame and talking about it in a natural way.
Right. So I went to a private Catholic school. So obviously when you put some sort of mandate or state legislation, however it would happen, a lot of times the private schools can still do whatever they want. So my sex ed growing up was a video on abstinence. It was like interviews with couples that had been together and they waited till marriage, and that's like how I was taught about sex in school.
Right.
But to be completely honest, like, I was exposed to sex at a very young age. I had a neighbor that showed me and my brother porn. We were, like, really young. We were, like, 9 to 10 years old, something like that, like, super-duper young. So, you know, that led me to kind of, oh, my gosh, what is this? I didn't even know that this existed, like, right, that you could put this in a place where everybody could see. Like, and it led me to kind of seek out, I guess, inaccurate sources of sex ed. You know, I'm asking older people, like older teenagers, I'm Googling stuff, you know, and then it's like I'm a 10-year-old figuring this stuff out by myself, mm-hmm, when in reality, like, if I had just been given the outlet I needed, given some sort of class, I could have avoided a lot of confusion and problems.
And the right kind of class can also say, look, this is the real thing, but you know what? You're going to find other stuff on, mm-hmm, the internet, in magazines, whatever, that's going to make it look like it's this other thing.
Right.
Don't pay attention to that. That's right. That's a commercialization of it. Right. So you could even address those things that, right, kids are going to be exposed to.
Right. And it's so different now. I was just having this conversation with my stepdad because I have a 12-year-old brother, and he was born in 2008. So he was born into a world with technology. And that's still relatively new territory. You know, they have access to things that, you know, maybe before, oh, we're not going to teach sex ed in school. And then maybe in like the 1970s, 1980s onwards, that works because, okay, now you've sheltered them. They don't have access to it. They don't know what it is. But that doesn't work anymore.
Nope.
You know, because like I said, it's everywhere. And, you know, they're getting phones so early, right, smartphones.
Yeah.
So they can find whatever they want. So I think that the trajectory of sex ed in school is going to change drastically because people, whether they have religious beliefs or conservative beliefs or not, I think people are going to start to see they're seeing it no matter
you
what.
You can't control it, so you can't control exposure to those other sources, so you might as well weigh in there,
right,
with a good, natural, shameless,
right,
message,
right?
Well, without shame, not
right,
shameless.
So we've had some prior conversations. Like I said, I'm relatively familiar with your work and your research. And I remember you told me about the genital pain, how that's one of your biggest contributions, and sort of what I've collected. And you might have mentioned it to me as well. But your other area was female desire. You've done a lot of substantial research in that area, and sort of what makes women tick in the bedroom, what turns specifically women on in the bedroom. So can you, for my female audience who might want to be more in touch with their sexuality, and especially for my young adult male audience that maybe wants to get ahead in life, could you sort of break down your research regarding how women are actually the source of their own desire, that like female self-erotic focus?
Well, let me first say how I came to that. I've come to a lot of my research ideas through my clinical work, through my work with couples and with women. And when I was treating women with low desire, one of the things that just jumped out at me time and time again was that it had more to do with the way they felt about themselves than the way they felt about their partner. And so that's how I started focusing on that component. And I don't just mean feel about yourself like, oh, you can't be depressed or anxious. No, whether they assess themselves to be sexy. Now, clearly, being the object of desire helps that a lot. But the funny thing about a lot of women is that even when they're the object of desire and they have a partner who's showing that in very real ways, which is very important to show your partner, if they don't buy it, if they don't think that they are in fact sexy, that's a real barrier. So it got me thinking that there's a real aspect to female sexual desire that is self-focused. And I don't mean that in any, I made the mistake years ago in the New York Times of using the word narcissism, which I didn't mean in a negative way. I mean, right. we all have to have a healthy amount of narcissism to get through life.
Right.
But that the way women feel about themselves might be a bigger factor in their arousal and desire than we've ever thought. Maybe more than men. But that's the kind of research that we're doing now. And so that's how I came to that idea. And so we wanted to call it something, you know, that didn't have any negative connotations, but at the same time, because I actually think it's cool. It means that there's an autonomy to female sexual
right.
desire, that you're in control of it to some extent, that you're not just, you know, hoping somebody finds you sexy, that of course we all want that, but that you have a lot of influence over your desire by working on yourself, whatever that means. And by the way, that means a very different thing to different women. And that's the research that that we have been doing. Mm-hmm.
So do you think that this is an area specifically female desire? Well, sexuality as a whole, taboo, not as researched as it should be in general. But specifically female sexuality, do you think that it's been under research because, you know, there's always such a taboo attached to women and sex, and just because, you know, I've seen how women have been portrayed throughout history, you know, as sex is something that just happens to them. Like, men pursue women, and then women just have sex with men because the men want sex.
Yeah.
It's really, even, you know, it's definitely changing in today's culture. But even today, it's still sort of taboo to see a woman pursuing sex from mm-hmm. a male or from whoever. You know, it's not as culturally accepted. It's not like the norm. So,
well, it's always been historically very difficult to find that sweet spot where female sexual desire is acceptable to society. You either are promiscuous and scary and, you know, the whole slut shaming thing,
right.
or you're that horrible word, frigid.
Yeah.
Right? So it was really interesting how, you know, society has been, or certainly Western society, has basically been trying to tell women there's a right amount of desire. You know, you can't have too much, you can't have too little. And women have been walking that tightrope for decades of,
right.
well, what's the right amount that
right.
makes me look like the right kind of woman? Now, we are seeing changes in that. I mean, culturally and music videos and so on and so forth.
Right.
But in real life, it's still a tricky issue.
Right, for sure. I remember reading that and seeing that, oh, wow, like, it doesn't always have to do with my partner, you know, because even as a young person, when, you know, your sex drive is probably supposed to be peak or high, you know, you have so many hormones and things like that. I've had experiences, because I've been in a long-term relationship, and I've had experiences where I'm like, I'm just not, like, feeling it. I'm not, and it's weird because it's like I'm young and I feel like it's supposed to be normal. You're always supposed to be in this state of like, oh, I'm ready to have sex. This is like, I'm young, I'm vital. This is what we do at this age. And in those times where I had low desire, I didn't feel great about myself,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there was a lot going on in my life. And there were a lot of different factors that were just kind of lowering my overall mental health
mm-hmm.
and my self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And reading that and seeing, oh, there's a way that, like you said, there's some autonomy, there's a way
yeah.
that I can do something about it. That was really validating.
I think it's an empowering message.
Right.
I really do.
Right.
That you do have some control over that. And by the way, I want to make sure that your audience knows that when I talk about whatever makes a woman feel sexy, make her feel sexy, that it doesn't have to be any kind of traditional, you know, cosmetic thing that's put out there by the world about how women should look. I mean, it can be that you just feel healthy. It can be that that you feel, like you said, that your esteem is high. It's not about wearing any specific thing.
Right.
You know, those are just superficial notions.
It's internal. It's mental.
Absolutely.
And obviously, because I took a COM 427 class last semester, and it's love and relationships, and it has to do with all these myths that the mainstream media and just our culture as a whole makes women buy into regarding, oh, this is what sex should be like. You know, you're supposed to make him feel this way, or this beauty standard where, you know, oh, you have to buy this makeup, you have to have this procedure, you have to, you know, oh, when you wear this, like this lingerie or whatever, this is going to make you more appealing. And it sort of makes women more focused on their appearance than maybe their career or their mental health or other things that will actually make them feel more complete as a whole, by distracting them with superficial things like beauty and makeup and clothes and things of that nature.
Absolutely.
So, you know, human sexuality is sort of a niche. Like if you were to walk into a waiting room or get on a train or a bus and someone has a book, it's probably going to be something like 7 steps to a healthy life or how to manage your business more efficiently, you know, more socially acceptable, air quotes, self-help books. You don't really see someone busting open a book like gender stereotypes in the bedroom or female, all things female sexuality. It's not a topic that's as normal or as acceptable to be educated in or to have interest in. And because of that, I feel like there's so much misunderstanding, like we've been saying. Right. People kind of look to cultural norms and cultural expectations and everything that's going on in the world as their source of information for what a relationship should look like or what sex should be like. And then you read these books, you know, from sex researchers, and you're like, oh, like the world's not going to be too happy when they read that one or when this comes out. So on the other hand, like I was saying, there's things for me that I read that were like, oh, like I'm really glad that somebody did research on this and put this out there, because now I don't feel like a terrible person or like something's wrong with me. And one of those things for me was this idea, you know, that you and other predominant sex researchers were challenging this idea that women could only thrive sexually in long-term relationships, or that they mainly thrive sexually in long-term relationships. And what I read is, you know, everybody get ready for this one, is that long-term relationships are actually really hard on female desire. It can make it dwindle and kind of kill that flame a little bit. And that's something that, like I said, I experienced, and I thought that something was wrong. You know, I thought it's me or it's him or so to read that, it was really like, wow, eye-opening. Can you elaborate a little bit on why long-term relationships are hard on female desire?
Well, they're hard on both male and female
Sexual
desire, because for a lot of people, novelty is an exciting part of sexuality. And when we're in long-term relationships, all sorts of other things happen, which are, by the way, super valuable, but they're not necessarily sex-inducing.
Right.
So to be clear, you know, both women and men see decreases in sexual desire for their partner over time. That doesn't mean it completely goes away. That doesn't mean you can't work on it. That doesn't mean there aren't things that you can do to kind of keep the flame alive. But is it the same as it was the first 2 weeks you had sex with each other? You know, for the most part, no, not 20 years into it. You might occasionally have an episode where it feels that way, but not not on a consistent basis. So it the research does show, though, that long-term relationships are harder on female sexual drive than on male sexual drive. So I did a study 10 years ago now with 19 happily married women who had lost sexual desire for their partner. Because, I mean, it's not that interesting if you're losing sexual desire for someone you don't like or don't get along with or are having conflict. I was interested in the ones who say, no, I adore him. He's great. No, he's great looking.
Right.
But I don't feel it.
Right.
Right. And so they had a lot of interesting things to say why. And one of them was, you know, the institutionalization of the relationship. The sex became, rather than, oh, this, you know, exciting thing that we sneak away to do, it was almost like it had become almost like an expectation.
Right.
It was almost like a chore on the to-do list. They talked about over-familiarity. You know, again, because sexuality tends to like novelty and mystery, you know, when, you know, you're washing each other's clothes and, you know, and picking up after each other, you know, you just get overly familiar. And part of what happens to couples is they stop trying to be romantic with each other. And even the initiation of sex is almost like, okay, what are we having for dinner? It can be really kind of rudimentary.
Mm-hmm.
And couples lose that kind of romantic, for lack of a better word, approach to each other.
Right.
And then, you know, there's a lot of roles that women take on that become quite desexualized. And a lot of women talked about losing their desire when they're taking care of kids. I remember one woman said to me, after like having three kids hanging off me all day, the last thing I want to do is to be touched. My fantasy, my sexual fantasy, she said, is getting in a bathtub
yeah.
with candles and everybody leaving me alone.
Yeah.
Right? So you can see how, you know, they had, and these were women who loved their husbands, who were trying to, you know, find ways of finding it again. And people do. So I don't want to make it sound like long-term relationships are doomed in terms of sexual desire. They're not.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think we need to be realistic so that you're not walking around feeling like there's something wrong with you because you have your, because it waxes and wanes over time.
Right. So there's, do you think that because the roles that are placed on women in relationships, because even though we've come a long way, there's still a lot of those, you know, oh, you need to be motherly, or, you know, you need to take care of, you know, these household chores. Like, it's definitely come a long way, but it's still, I know a lot of people that still accept those roles in their own relationship and expect it from women. So do you think that because there's more roles imposed on women, that's why it's harder on female desire than it is on male desire? Or is it like a biological thing?
I think it can be both. And
yeah.
Most times it is both. So what I would say is I agree with you. We have come a long way, but the data still shows that the largest burden of childcare does continue to fall on women.
Yeah.
Not to the same extent as before, but still super unequal. So clearly that's part of it. You know, a potential biological explanation is that male sexual drive is hardier, that it's less susceptible to being negatively affected than women's sexual desire. So if you're starting, and again, this is an if, but if you're starting with different levels of desire and the male one might be a little hardier or higher, then when something dampens it, it can take out the female one. It's lowering the male, but there's still some left.
Right.
So, you know, biologically, if you want to talk in terms of evolution, it could also be that it wouldn't make sense in nature to have women who are trying to ensure the viability of their offspring to be wanting to have, I mean, if we think of ourselves as animals for a second,
right.
In the jungle, you know,
right.
We are a species in which our offspring are not viable, meaning they can't survive on their own for a very long time.
Right.
In most other species, within a couple of months, you know, the kitten can do it and the puppy can do it. But our babies, you know, take a long time to be viable.
Right.
Well, if you think from an evolutionary point of view, would it make sense for women to be highly sexually desirous when they have child rearing to do? Again, in a primitive kind of jungle, you know, bringing it down to thinking of ourselves as animals with biological, you know, imperatives to transmit our genes.
Right.
You know, so I think that, you know, it's likely a combination of some biological wiring, but then you just cannot ignore this huge societal trip that we place on female sexuality. Teasing those two apart is really, really difficult. You can't. So you kind of look at data that tells you that it looks like it's a combination of all of that, you know.
Right.
On the other hand, one of the paradoxical things about female sexual desire is because it might not be as automatic as male is, it actually requires more to trigger. And that more can be novelty, things that we tend to associate with male sexual desire. That you know, it's like if you're not hungry and I show you a really beautiful chocolate cake, you might still eat it even though you're not hungry. Well, it's the same thing. If female sexual desire is not quite as high, then what needs to happen to trigger it is going to be more, something more exciting.
Right. Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's really, I always like thinking of things in terms of like an evolutionary perspective, because there's so many things. I took a psychology class in high school, and that's what really made me stop and be like, oh, like there's so many behaviors that we do today that we think are just normal that were things that helped people survive however long, whenever the human species started. These are the behaviors that helped, you know, natural selection. These people were selected to survive because of the choices that they made. So that's why we do these things. And I remember reading in a book, It's Untrue by Wednesday Martin. I'll write all these books and their titles and authors in the episode description so you guys can check them out. It's really worth the read. But Untrue is a book about specifically female infidelity and female sexuality. And she has a background in anthropology, so she takes more of, you know, a different approach to it. She looks at, you know, she looked at, I think, a species of fruit flies and a species of bonobos, and she compared their data to human data and how, because it's about infidelity. So she talked about how in, I think it was bonobos, the research that she did, she found that the more males that the females had sex with, the better chances their babies, the female babies, had of surviving, because all these different guys now, all these different male bonobos, thought that it was their baby, you know, because they didn't have, bonobos don't have DNA testing, so they have no idea.
Right.
So the female is having sex with multiple different males within her little tribe, because then that ensures her survival and her baby's survival. And then she compared that to human beings and how, you know, that could be a part of why human beings have like this wandering eye. And it's things like that, those connections that people don't make on a surface level. You know, you have to do that research. It's not something that's taught in school.
Right.
It's not a mindset that you're encouraged to have. And that's why there's so much misunderstanding.
Absolutely.
About so much.
You know, maternity is certain. Every mother knows they gave birth to that baby. I mean, paternity isn't, unless you do a DNA test,
right?
And just that very simple difference is probably responsible for all sorts of behaviors, right? Just that simple difference. And there's even been studies showing how much more invested young fathers are in saying that the baby looks like them.
Right.
And how moms will tend to say the same thing and believe it. And could it be that everyone's trying to ensure
right.
that he knows he's the father, so he stays around and provides the resources that will help
right.
survival, right? So fascinating
right.
questions that, as you say, you know, we tend to think, oh, we're above the animal kingdom. We're not driven by these forces. Of course we are.
Right.
You know, we're more complex, and culture then, you know, steps in and does something with that that sometimes, you know, counters it or doesn't, sometimes makes it even more. But of course we are subject to all sorts of kind of evolutionarily wired adaptive behaviors.
Right. So kind of in line with what we were just talking about, I do want to touch on that. I don't even know if I really want to touch on it, because to be honest, it's something that has really affected my life personally, but it would be going against, you know, the reason why I started this podcast, to avoid it, and that's infidelity, colloquially known as cheating. It's a touchy topic for everyone, including myself. It has affected me personally, unfortunately, in a number of ways. To be completely transparent with everyone listening and with you, I have seen both sides of this issue. I have been both the perpetrator and the victim of infidelity. The first experience I had with it, I was the one who was disloyal. I did not have sex with the person outside of my relationship, but I did take an obvious interest in someone outside of my relationship. And my opinion of cheating from that point forward became very complicated, because, you know, I had this opinion of cheating and infidelity before I had ever experienced it in any way. So, you know, you're just taught growing up, oh, that's bad, don't do that, anyone who does that is bad. So that's kind of this perspective that I had. And then for me to be the person committing acts of infidelity really shook my world up, because I was like, I was raised on this premise that these are really, really terrible people, but I don't want to be a really terrible person. I don't want to feel like I'm a really terrible person. And I really struggled. I struggled with that. I struggled with the feelings that I had towards this other person and how I could still love my partner but want to be with somebody else physically at the same time. And that's actually what motivated me to start researching the topic, because I was like, how is this possible? And why, like, do other people not experience this? Like, I don't understand. Because for me, I was like, I'm not trying to hurt anybody. It's really just how I feel. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I made bad decisions. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not taking away all sort of accountability or responsibility, but the impulses are very real and very strong. And I didn't realize how that was possible.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I started researching it, to see, you know, what could have caused this. And so, very complex opinion. And then when the roles were reversed, and I had experienced it from the other side, it complicated everything for me even more. It exacerbated everything, and it really was hard for me, because now I'm just, I did my research and I had my opinion, and then it's just like a bomb was dropped into all of my logic. And now, I mean, I guess that's life for you. But I really just don't know what to make of it now, because it's definitely harder to see infidelity from an objective psychological perspective when you've been hurt by it.
Right.
So what I want to ask you is, from your research, do you think, if there's a difference at all, that women or men struggle more with monogamy? And for anyone that doesn't know what monogamy means, it just means exclusivity and being
right.
with one person.
I don't know that I'm in a position to say who struggles more with it. I think we deal with it differently. So first of all, what I would say, it is perfectly normal to feel attracted to any number of people over your lifetime, even when you're with somebody. Especially, you know, when we talk about, you know, long-term relationships kind of falling into that rut where you no longer feel like really the object of desire, sex starts to feel like this thing that has to happen, like having dinner or, you know, or taking a shower. And suddenly someone from the outside is looking at you with new eyes and you see yourself in that reflection and it feels so good. We should all just admit that that is normal, that that happens, and it's normal that that feels good. Why wouldn't it? The thing is, we then have to make a choice. So the feeling of being excited by somebody finding you attractive, that you find attractive even when you're in a relationship, is perfectly normal. And there are communities and couples who decide that they don't want to make that choice, and they don't want to choose monogamy. They want to be open to those experiences. And we get what we call polyamory. And those are folks who agree with each other that they may have a primary relationship, but that they have sex with other people. Not a lot of people pull that off really, really well, okay? Mm-hmm. But there are communities that abide by that. But for those of us who don't feel like we would handle that very well, then we have to make choices. And sometimes we choose that other person who's not your primary relationship, and you either discover that you don't want to be in this relationship anymore, or that you're going with this other person, or you feel horrible because you made a mistake that was just physically gratifying, but now it's ruined something that you value more. Right. So look, if we were to spend our lifetime chasing that feeling, there's a bunch of things you'd give up. And that's okay. Everybody can make that choice. I've been married for 33 years. If I were to have chased that feeling I had with other people during those 33 years, I would have wrecked my relationship. I would not have had the companionship, the love, the commitment, and some of the most wonderful things that I value more than that gratification. But it's a choice. I don't say that morally. Mm-hmm. Like if somebody says to me, I'm sorry, that feeling that you're talking about there, that means the world to me, and I am going to chase that for as long as I can, I would say, well, good for you. I have no problem with you doing that. But it is a choice, and it is a trade-off.
Right. So it's such a complex topic, man. I know I'm not going to get into specifics because I don't want to name any names or anything, but I know people that prefer that novelty, that mm-hmm. thrill, that experience of something new. And that's just kind of how they're wired. Mm-hmm. They've always been like that. That's what makes them happy. I see it in all areas of their life where they need that novelty and that newness. And they left their primary relationship, which was a marriage, mm-hmm. To pursue that. And they are not necessarily talked about in the most positive way by other people for that decision, specifically by other members of my family, mm-hmm. Because they think that something is wrong with this person for, oh, you're however old, I'm not going to say their age, but you're this old, and you're still chasing that, like you don't want to just settle down. Like, what's wrong with you that you want to chase that and you want that, like, novel experience? Like, it's something that's really, really stigmatized. Mm-hmm. So do you feel like, have you seen that in society?
How yes, I have.
It's stigmatized?
It's definitely stigmatized, and I don't think it should be stigmatized as long as it is a conscious choice, and you're being honest with your partners. The honesty part is real important, right? You know? So as long as there isn't deception about it. If somebody says, look, I have weighed the pros and cons of the benefits of a long-term relationship versus the benefits of chasing that feeling, and frankly, I think I'm going to chase that feeling. Now, a lot of the chasers of that feeling do get to an age where chasing isn't as successful as it was. So, you know, I mean, if let's use movie stars, because I mean, and your audience won't know these people very well because they're old, but like you look at someone like Warren Beatty, who certainly came across as someone who's chasing that his whole life. And when he's like 55 or something, he marries Annette Bening, and then he has kids late in life. So, you know, as long as the choice, it's a conscious choice that you're honest with yourself and with your partners.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why that should be judged.
Right.
You may think, oh, you're making a big mistake because you're going to be a sorry old guy one day and no one's going to be taking care of you when the chase is no longer an option.
Yeah.
You may think that. You have a right to think that about something like that. But that's a choice. Mm-hmm. And then, as I said, there are these open marriages or not marriage at all, or just arrangements.
So do you think people who engage in these open arrangements and polyamorous relationships and whatnot, are not prone to infidelity, or it's like a way for them to combat infidelity more so than monogamous couples?
No, they're reframing it. They're not saying it's infidel. There's nothing, you know, infidelity means, you know, you are not trustworthy. I mean,
right.
They're saying, no, this isn't infidelity, because we are all agreeing that we have an open relationship, so there's no cheating.
Right.
Now, if all of the people in that group can handle the psychological aspect of that, because, of course, it's only human to want to be the most desired, right? And so, you know, but, you know, polygamy... Now, that's not polyamory,
right,
but polygamy has existed for centuries in certain cultures where, of course, it was all just one man and a lot of women. I don't know too many cases of the other way around.
Right.
They had no power, you know, to whether they felt jealous or not or whatever. But it's clearly psychologically a difficult thing to navigate because of our natural tendency to want to be the one.
Right. And this is something that's always been a little bit confusing to me, because this has been a topic that I have done. I wrote a paper last semester on polyamory and different polyamorous cultures and whatnot. And it's always been confusing to me that we have multiple of every other type of relationship in our life. We have, can you imagine how terrible it would feel to only be able to have one friend at a time, and how sick you would get of that person, and how they would drive you crazy. Or, you know, parents have multiple children. They're all completely different. They love you. No one blinks an eye. Oh, you love all your kids the same? Yeah, that makes sense. But when it comes to romantic relationships, it's like, oh, it's not possible. And it's always confused me, because you do see jealousy a little bit, I guess, like in siblings when you're younger, or between best friends.
But not
like,
to the same extent.
Right. So what's different about romantic relationships that makes people like, is it cultural? Is it biological? Like, why is it so different?
Well, again, if we go back to the evolutionary argument, then you could say it has everything to do with having... with ensuring the viability of offspring. And so if you are committed to one person and that person feels culturally they can't leave you unless there's a divorce, then that assures the resources of that person for the offspring, right? So that's one potential. It is pretty, I mean, there are variations, but let's face it, the norm across most of the world is monogamy.
Right.
Serial monogamy these days, but monogamy.
Yeah. Right. So
when you see something happen so universally, especially when it doesn't favor the patriarchy, really, in the sense that, you know, men have a long history culturally of having their things on the side, you've got to think that there must be some biological reason for it. And it's always if you go down that route, and a lot of people don't like when we go down that route, by the way, because they think that it's an excuse for bad behavior.
Right.
To me, it's not an excuse or not an excuse. It's not, this isn't a moral thing.
Right.
I don't talk in terms of excuses. We're just trying to understand, and you're right. And part of the problem with that is that then your partner, unlike your friends that you have 10 or 20 of, has to be everything to you.
Right.
That's really hard to pull off, right?
Right.
And why marriages often, you know, have trouble, because you're expecting your partner to be, you know, your lover, your caretaker, your cheerleader, your handyman, and that's a lot to put on one person. So it is kind of problematic, but it is kind of ubiquitous across the world.
Right.
So that always makes me think that it has something to do with ensuring the survival.
Right. And I can see that, because it makes sense when you say, like, you know, people across the world, all different backgrounds, cultures, everything, but it's still consistent. Like, there has to be some factor. But I just think, like, in terms, you know, because there's individual experiences that are different, and I think in terms of my own experiences that I've had, where I'm trying not to divulge too many details in respect for everybody involved, but I have felt attracted to other people for different reasons from my primary partner without ever seeing my primary partner as less.
Right.
You know, nothing that this person has takes away from what he has.
Right.
So that's not, but then, you know, when it is like, oh, well, I don't want him to like other people too, though. You know,
right.
I just want it to be me.
Right.
So it's hard because I have very conflicting desires and beliefs and values, because I know that this other person is nice for this reason, but they're not as nice as my primary partner. They just offer something different or in the moment. But I still love my primary partner and don't want to give that up with him.
Right.
But then, you know, if he were to tell me something like that, I'd be like, no. That's not okay.
No, that's exactly.
Like, what don't I have that this person has?
Right.
And I don't get how it's so, like, different. You can have completely contrasting feelings at the same time.
Yeah.
That's the worst to me.
Right.
Because that's when I've made bad decisions.
Yeah. And like you said, it makes sense until it happens to you.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so there's obviously some primal thing where it's like, okay, you can go see all of these other women, to go to the movies, to do this, to that, but do not tell me that you're having sex with one. You can do all of these other things that might be actually really super meaningful.
Right.
Like have huge emotional moments of connection, reading about literature, discussing politics, whatever, but not sex.
Right.
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 So, you know, and not that people can't get jealous about emotional attachments, because they do too. But I think often that's because you think it might lead to something else.
Right. So from what I gathered in Untrue, that book that I mentioned earlier by Dr. Wincy Martin, you're not opposed to the idea that women prefer relationships more than men do, but you think that women are like just as sexually driven as men. They just tend to choose relationships.
Right.
More than men do.
Yes.
Over novelty.
I think the mistake we have made is that because women have chosen relationships over what we're going to call chasing that feeling, that it's because that feeling isn't strong for them.
Right.
What I'm saying is, oh no, it is.
Yeah.
but they make different choices. Well, and I shouldn't generalize. There are lots of men who make that choice too.
Right.
But they're making a choice about valuing one thing more than another. But don't ever get wrong that they don't value being desired, feeling desirous, you know, novelty. And as I said, because they're sexual desire tends to get dampened more, those things become even more important.
Right.
Because it takes more to trigger.
Right.
And so that's the vulnerability. Right. Yeah. But that's the mistake we've made, that because women choose relationships, for the most part, not always, obviously, everybody thinks, oh, it's relationships that turn women on, or long-term relationships. And it's like, no, actually, what turns women on is very similar to what turns men on.
Right.
They just choose the relationship over that.
Right.
It's a choice.
Yeah. I this is something that I really wish was taught in school. Because, you know, that stereotype of women, that is one stereotype as a woman that I have experienced, like, over and over and over and over again. Whether it be from male friends or my own boyfriend, where they're just like, oh, women just get attached way more easy. Like, they just have more... They just have a softer spot. It's easier for them to fall into a relationship and to catch feelings. And I've never felt like that, you know, so it's frustrating to hear that, because it's like...
When I made this point on the Oprah show 12 years ago, I got thousands of emails. I wasn't on social media, so it didn't go that route, but I got thousands of emails from women saying, thank you for telling it like it is, because everybody gets it wrong. And as a matter of fact, a lot of women said to me that there's a kind of romanticness that some of their partners had that actually didn't turn them off at all, that they were more attracted to, again, a kind of more risque kind of approach to sexuality than the rose.
Right. Yeah, this is just stuff that I feel like this is stuff that's becoming more accepted, especially like in my generation and people younger than me. But yeah, it really is like super validating to hear. I'm just really glad that people are going to have the opportunity to hear it.
And I had women say to me that they wouldn't even admit that stuff in a group of other women because they would be afraid to sound like there was something like
weird or off. So is there anything that I missed that you want to add or that you wanted to touch on that I didn't cover?
No, I would just, first of all, I'm so impressed that you're willing to talk about these things and to talk about them with the honesty and vulnerability that you do. And for all of us to know that, you know, we really don't have anything to hide. The only people who aren't saying these things are not saying these things because they're afraid of the judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But if we were all honest about how sexuality works and how it unfolds, it's not going to become any less complex, but at least we won't walk around this world thinking that there's something wrong with us. And that's just so empowering, and it's so powerful. So I just want to say that I'm really impressed that you're tackling these issues.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you guys for tuning in. I will have Dr. Miana's contact information in case you guys wanted to reach out with any further questions. And I will also attach all the books that I have read that she has mentioned in. As always, thank you guys for talking elephants with me. And I will see you in 2 weeks for the last episode of the season.